Good morning, and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. Our guest today is Kiki, owner of Himalayan Dumplings, the first woman-owned Tibetan food brand in the U.S., which makes and sells Tibetan dumplings, or momos, and Tibetan hand pies. Kiki's parents and grandparents fled Tibet when the Chinese invaded in 1959 and settled in the town of Darjeeling in India, where Kiki grew up. She immigrated to the U.S. a little over 20 years ago and now lives in Oregon with her family. To help preserve her Tibetan culture, especially for her daughters, Kiki started selling homemade momos and hand pies at the Beaverton Night Market 8 years ago. You can buy the Himalayan Dumplings momos and hand pies frozen and cook them on demand at home or eat them fresh at the new Himalayan Dumplings Cafe in Beaverton. We talk with Kiki about her experience as a Tibetan refugee, the food she grew up with and loves, and what it's like to start a one-woman business in Portland, working up from the pop-ups at local markets to her own brick-and-mortar restaurant. Just a note that Kiki prefers not to use her last name professionally for reasons of privacy. Please join us for our conversation with Kiki, which is already in progress. Well, Kiki, thanks so much for joining us today. Tashi Dele.
Tashi Dele, thank you so much for having me and giving me space on your platform to share my Tibetan story. Thank you.
Which is a fascinating story, and we'll start from the beginning. You grew up in Darjeeling in India, and that was in the late 70s and 80s with your grandparents and parents. They were born and living in Tibet in the capital city of Lhasa, but they escaped on foot across the Himalayas to India when the Chinese invaded in 1959. That's also when the Dalai Lama, who was 23 at the time, also fled the country to safety in Dharamsala, also in India. Did your parents and grandparents ever talk to you about their journey, which must have been extremely dangerous and difficult?
Hardly. It's a story that wasn't talked about very much. Yeah, it wasn't until later years, in my adult years, when I came to the U.S., I asked questions. And occasionally my mom and dad will tell me a little bit about it, but it's I think part of their life experience, yeah, that for various reasons they don't talk very much about it.
Well, I'm sure it was traumatic. I mean, it's the same with Jewish survivors of the Holocaust or like my dad, people who were in the military in World War II. There's certain things that they'd rather not talk about, and I understand that.
Yeah.
Now, how did they end up in Darjeeling, which is a small town in India, rather than Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama and a lot of Tibetan refugees went? And there's actually, I looked it up on a map, there's quite a distance between the two, about 1,000 miles.
There is. Darjeeling, from what I understand, Darjeeling and another town called Kalimpong, which is in northeast of India, were places that are close proximity to Tibet. So even before the invasion of Tibet, from what I understand, there were trade relations. And so there were Tibetans that had settled, early migrants that had settled in Darjeeling and Kalimpong. And I think that was one of the reasons why it made it kind of a no-brainer of sorts. And also the weather, I'd imagine, had a role to play, because Darjeeling is cold and rainy. And from the little bits of stories that my parents have shared with me, my grandmother, for example, from my mom's side, my mom's mother passed away because when they fled Tibet, they settled first in South India, if I'm not mistaken, where they were hired to build roads, do road construction and stuff like that. And from what I understand, many, many, many Tibetans passed away due to heat-related diseases.
Working on the roads.
Yeah, yeah. And my grandmother was one of them. So Darjeeling, in terms of weather, is, I guess, as close to Tibet as possible. It's cold. It rains a lot. It's not hot.
So Oregon's probably a little bit of home for you there.
Yeah, yes.
Wet and cold, especially this time of year.
Yes, absolutely. So many similarities.
What was it like growing up in Darjeeling that you were in a community of Tibetan refugees?
Correct, correct. When I was young, I honestly did not think much about the occupation of Tibet or the impacts of that I was living. It was what I had always known. So I didn't have anything much to compare. As I grew up and I reflect back on certain experiences, I realized that there were many instances that we just took it as it is what it is to be a Tibetan kind of thing. And upon hindsight, when I look back, there were certainly many instances, such as crossing the border, even traveling between Darjeeling and Nepal, for example, at the border. It was very, very, very normal to be harassed, to show paperwork, because they know that many Tibetans didn't have paperwork. And I thought that's just how it was for everybody. I didn't think much of it. It was just something that I expected it as a child. But looking back, I realized that there definitely were quite a few instances that I experienced what I experienced because of my refugee status.
Were you taught the Tibetan language and culture and history, or were there any restrictions placed by the Indian government on that?
There were absolutely no restrictions per se. At that time, being for my parents, for example, by the time I was born, they would probably have lived in India for a couple of decades, maybe. So then at that time, their priority was to get me an English education to be able to survive in the new environment, to be able to thrive. And so at that time, the generation mindset was send them to English schools, send kids to English schools if you can afford. My parents at that time were teachers. My mom was a nurse, my dad was a designer, and later they became teachers, carpet designer, Tibetan rug designer. And so I remember they used to save up every penny, give English tuitions to kids. So they can save up money to send me to. I went to a Christian boarding school in India, in Darjeeling, and in that school, English was the medium through which we were taught all subjects. I even Bible. It was a Christian school, so Bible was actually a subject I learned quite well, Old Testament and New Testament, and Tibetan was just one class. So my reading and writing, in particular, was fairly limited.
Now, from Darjeeling, you emigrated to the US, and that was about 20 years ago when you were in your 20s. How'd you end up in Oregon?
I ended up in Oregon because after I graduated from college in Delhi, India, the capital of India, I moved to Nepal to be with my parents who were living there as teachers. They had a school. And it was there that I started translating for an American family, an organization that would come to Nepal and were interested in Tibetan Buddhism in particular. So after graduating from college in English literature, I started translating. And I remember one day they asked me, so by my first name, my name on paper is Tenzin, like many Tibetans. My first name is Tenzin. So they were like, Tenzin, what would you like to do? What is your dream? And I remember saying, my dream is to go to America. I was not eager to get settled and get married and have children. I wanted to explore and learn more. And I had always had this imagination of what America was like and the American dream and through movies and things like that. And so I said, I want to go to America. And so one day they said, Tenzin, would you like to go to America? And I was like, yeah, what do I need to do? And so anyway, long story short, that's why I ended up in Oregon, is because they lived here.
You've said that when you settled in Oregon, like many immigrants, you just wanted a good paying job and a stable job. And you found that as a business development manager.
Correct, yeah. My only goal, my primary goal that I was driven by was having a stable life. I think as refugees, we tend to because of the circumstances that we are in, where stability is not, you know, it's removed from you, you're displaced, you're having to fight constantly to survive in host countries and things like that. Stability was a huge motivation for me, and that meant financial sustenance and financial stability. And so, yeah, along those lines, I was a business development manager for about 15 years in a software company.
During that time, you also married and you had children. You have children.
Correct.
And becoming a mother inspired you to learn how to prepare Himalayan dumplings, or momos, as they're called
Correct.
In Tibet. You talk about how your grandmother made potato momos back in Darjeeling, which was a very memorable part of your childhood. But I don't think you mentioned that she taught you how to make them at the time. You were kind of in the next room or on the other side of the wall smelling the potato
Yes.
dumplings, and every now and then sneaking a piece of the potatoes, but you weren't
Yes.
making them. You weren't
No.
making them on your own.
No, I was not. I must have been around 4 or 5, I think. Yeah. We had a tiny room that was divided into two by a very thin wall. One was the kitchen area, and one was a living room slash bedroom that turned into a bedroom at night. So I would remember I would do my homework or things like that in the living room. And the wall is so thin, you can smell or hear everything that's going on in the kitchen. And yes, one of my most memorable childhood memories is of my momola, which is grandmother in Tibetan, momola, who used to make shogo momo, potato dumplings, Tibetan dumplings, yeah. And just the simple smells of freshly boiled momo, you know, potato. I don't know, it was just so simple and so delicious. And
Yes.
yeah, I used to sneak into the kitchen and gobble up pieces of potato, boiled potatoes.
Yeah, that's interesting that the Tibetan word for grandmother is very similar to the Tibetan word for dumplings.
Correct. Yes, yes.
Momola
Just
and momos.
Yes, spelt as, yes, colloquially, yes, very similar, yes.
I guess both can be very comforting. Maybe that's
yes.
The relationship.
Absolutely, absolutely, very comforting.
Now, how did you learn to make momos while living here in Oregon? I don't think they were available anywhere. I think yours were the first.
Correct, yeah. It was out of necessity. I craved for Tibetan food. And so because there were no Tibetan eateries around the west side of Portland in particular, actually at that time there were none, because the one Tibetan restaurant that was open in Portland closed shortly after they opened. So yeah, it was out of necessity. I learned how to make. In the beginning, I wasn't very good at it. But going back to a taste memory, you know, of how you recall how momola used to make it, how my family used to make it, I started to improve. And yeah.
And what about the hand pies? They're called shabalep in
Correct.
Tibetan. And did your grandmother make those too? What you must have had those back when you were growing up in Darjeeling.
Yeah, those actually, my memories to the shabhale or Tibetan hand pies are tied to my early teenagers when we used to go on picnics. Tibetan culture, picnics, linga, as we say in Tibetan, are a big part of Tibetan culture, especially in the summertime. It's kind of carried over from days life in Tibet when summer, when the sun came out and, you know, it wasn't extremely cold. People would go out for picnics, and picnics could last for days. It was very elaborate. Yeah. But where we lived as refugees in Nepal or India, picnics were not for days. It was just a one-day trip thing. And so my memory to shabhale, Tibetan hand pies, deep-fried Tibetan hand pies, are tied to my early teenage years when we would rent a minibus, as we called it, and all the families would chip in money towards the rental. And we would make a pilgrimage tour out of it. It would be a pilgrimage tour to the holy Tibetan Buddhist sites. And it would be, when we were done, it would be a picnic, a potluck style. Everybody would bring out their own dishes. And shabhale was always, always one of those dishes that were part of our linga, because it maintains really well, even at room temperature.
And it seems like a perfect finger food, picnic food.
Absolutely. So delicious.
Now let's get to your business, Himalayan Dumplings, and how it got started. The idea came to you about 8 years ago, I think, on a visit to the Beaverton Night Market.
Absolutely, yes. It was a very organic, it's been a very organic journey. I didn't have any grand vision at the beginning or anything like that. It was a very, I went to Beaverton Night Market. It was the first annual Beaverton Night Market that the city of Beaverton had launched. And it was my experience there. I took my two girls. I remember they were little then. And it was my experience there when I kind of had an epiphany. And I was like, my gosh, here are, I saw foods being represented from cultures that you don't necessarily see in the mainstream restaurant ecosystem. And after watching how people interacted, and I realized that, gosh, food is such a powerful medium to tell a cultural story, to learn more about cultures, you know, different cultures, especially ones that are underrepresented, like ours. And that kind of inspired me. I was very scared because I had no culinary, professional culinary background. Up until then, it was just a very micro effort at home within the walls of my home to teach my girls, they're half Cambodian, half Tibetan, to teach them about Tibetan culture through our food. I had never taken those efforts outside of our home, but when I saw Beaverton Night Market, I was like, I have to do this somehow. So I remember applying. I set a reminder on my phone, and I remember applying the following year. I never told anyone because I'm like, for sure, I'm not going to get my application get accepted. I'd have no professional background. And yeah, so that was the early seeds.
I should mention also, because I was fascinated when I learned it, Beaverton is considered one of the most diverse communities in the country. I think it's over 40% immigrant people from other cultures, so non-white Caucasian Americans. So now you've added the Tibetan food to that diversity.
Yes, and it's totally my honor. I feel so honored to be able to represent Tibetan culture in some ways. I feel because there's so few of us that have the opportunity to represent, I feel like in some ways my responsibility is that of an ambassador. So even when I started doing farmers markets, for example, about a year or so ago, and I had my first hire who was a Tibetan high school girl, I remember telling her that, remember, we aren't just selling frozen, ready to cook Himalayan dumplings and momo. We're actually representing, you're an ambassador of a Tibetan culture. For many people who meet at farmers market, it'll be their first interaction with Tibetan culture, you know? So, and that's truly still, it's that mindset I still have.
Well, it must have been an extremely strong mindset and motivation, Kiki, because you were working full time and you were raising two young girls, two daughters. So to take on all that additional work, stress, and expense, I think you put a lot of your life savings into starting the business. So that kept you going, that kind of representing Tibetan culture.
Absolutely. It's my why. When I have, I get a lot of, now that my following on social media has grown over time, I get a lot of private messages and DMs of people asking me, you know, what advice would you give to a new entrepreneur? And I truly say it may sound so simple, but I can't emphasize how important it is. It is like, figure out what is your why? Aside from money, like, what is your why? And it's my why that keeps me going on days when I'm so mentally and physically exhausted, on days when I feel self-doubt. It really is my why that anchors me.
And I think those are 10 to 12 hour workdays between Himalayan dumplings and your day job.
Yes. Up until about a year or so ago, I was working my full-time job as a business development manager and then doing the build out and everything. Yeah, so it easily was a 70-hour job. I have scaled back a little bit, but I definitely work more than 40 hours still out of necessity because I'm self-funded. So all of the capital is from whatever sales I make. And then, as you said, my life savings that I poured into it. But my hope is that 2024, which is very soon, my hope is that I can start hiring more so I can work towards a little bit more of a work-life balance.
And I should mention a big milestone. I read one of your latest posts on social media. You mentioned you had taken out a business loan, a line of credit, and you were able to pay it back just before the interest kicked in.
Yes, that was a huge That was such a big milestone for me. I felt a big weight off of my shoulders. Yeah, the life savings that I poured into it and every penny that I reinvested back from farmers market sales, from the cafe sales and all of that, wasn't enough because the expenses, the startup expenses for the construction as well as the commercial equipment was so high. So I had to resort to credit card, business credit card. So I got that, and gosh, I think I had over $20,000 in credit card debt, which was so scary for me because I don't like to borrow what I cannot afford in my personal life. If I can't afford it, I won't buy it as much as I want it. But in this case, I felt it was very essential in order for me to have a fighting chance to scale and sustain. And so I did that. And so I had a reminder on my phone. I use my phone a lot as a reminder. I had a reminder, don't forget to pay this to this man, this one. So I was chipping away. And right before the 0% interest offer expired, I paid off the final balance. And so it was just recently. Yeah, so I'm so grateful.
Yeah,
So
what an
grateful.
incredible story. I want to go back to that first night, your first night at the Beaverton Night Market. Apparently, you were in a 10 by 10 foot tent. It was very hot. You had borrowed cookware. You were using a kind of a tin box to hold your cash, and you were selling the momos and hand pies. And to represent the culture, you also had Tibetan prayer flags decorating the booth, the tent.
Correct. Yeah, it was a very surreal experience. I felt so nauseous from anxiety and nervousness. I still do, actually. I'm like, I don't know why I can't get over that butterflies in my tummy feeling. But yeah, it was, oh gosh. And I remember when we had set up, my siblings were helping, my in-laws were all helping. There must have been around eight or so of us helping. And I remember the bell rang or something to indicate that the event had officially started. And within a few minutes, I remember the market manager, Jody, Beaverton Night Market manager, Jody, saying, "Do you know you have a line around the block?" I was like,
That's
"Oh!" And then
incredible.
the pressure felt even more. I was so nervous, and she's like, "I'm so sorry, but we're going to have to move the, what do they call those cones to kind
Oh,
of."
traffic cones.
Yeah, those traffic cones. She's like, "We're going to have to readjust. Okay, so your lines are blocking all the vendors that are near you." I was like, "Oh my gosh." Yeah,
Now,
so.
how'd they get word? Was that the Tibetan community in Portland, or did you advertise it all or promote it on social media?
Up until then, I was using social media to tell. Just to share my story as I'm doing now, my journey. And I was using social media then as well, in the same way, storytelling as I always have. And so that really, truly, social media was, I think, the number one help that I got in amplifying not only my story, but also the fact that it was my first pop-up at Beaverton Night Market.
I should mention something else you're very proud of. Himalayan Dumplings is the first woman-owned Tibetan food brand in the US. And you sell both meat-based and vegan-friendly momos and hand pies. Let's talk about the food a little, which is delicious. I've had it. Can you tell us about some of the fillings and also the sauces that come with them? I know there's one, it's a little too hot for my wife, but I love it. It's delicious. And I think it's called Sepen,
Yeah.
Sepen.
Yeah, Sippy is how you pronounce it. And it was inspired by my auntie, who's now in her 80s. We grew up eating that spicy Tibetan garlic chili sauce. Sibe is the word for all things hot sauce in Tibetans, and Tibetans are quite fond of eating spicy food. And so, yeah, we grew up eating that sibe with roasted potatoes that my auntie would char over coals. And that's how we ate the sibe. So I have very fond memories, and it was because of her and the sipe she made that inspired me to make that sipe, which is one of the two hot sauces that I included in our frozen take and make or ready to cook Himalayan dumplings, already baked Tibetan hand pies. The other sauce is a mild Himalayan cilantro sauce, which I intentionally made very mild because I know not everyone can handle a lot of heat.
Yes,
So I
I like
purposely
to
did.
actually mix them.
You do? Yes, it's very interesting hearing from customers how they each do that. Someone told me that they break up the sibe and they thaw it and then they put it in an ice cube tray and make the multiple servings out of it because a little bit goes a long way. And so they said that's what they were. I was like, that's so genius. Yeah, but as far as the flavors are concerned, for now I have three Himalayan dumpling Amomo flavors. One is veggie and shiitake, which is vegan friendly, and the other two are classic juicy beef, and one is chicken and cilantro. We also have a couple of Shapali or Tibetan hand pie options. One is curried potato, which was inspired by my time living in Darjeeling. It's a kind of a confluence of both Tibetan and Nepali culture, specifically to the Darjeeling community where I grew up. And then the other one is chicken and cilantro shapali.
Now, during the pandemic, which caused quite a bit of change for all of us, you decided to start freezing and packaging the momos and hand pies. What was the reason for that?
I'm so glad you asked. It's a story I don't share very often. Prior to pandemic, or even during pandemic, because I was only doing seasonal pop-ups, primarily during summer season, because I had a full-time job, I used to get asked a lot, where else can we buy a food after your pop-ups are over? How come you don't sell frozen? Those are very frequently asked questions that I used to get, and I just didn't have the bandwidth at that time. Neither did I have the motivation to scale and do anything further beyond the seasonal pop-ups. During the pandemic, all of the pop-up events, the in-person events, stopped. That
Oh,
was
yes.
one. And two, I remember searching online one day, something came up, and a business article from India came up. And that article led me down a rabbit hole of finding more articles. And basically, I learned that day that there are multiple multi-million dollar Momo brands in India, and none of them are owned by Tibetan. And that lit a fire in me that I was like, this is insane. I mean, on the one hand, I can understand, like I was telling you earlier in the interview, as refugees, I can get that risk averseness. I'm very risk averse by nature. I think it's just how I grew up. Don't ruffle feathers, stick to something safe and stable. I think it's just a byproduct of the refugee ecosystem, when you're displaced and things like that. But yeah, when I saw those articles and I started clicking on each brand, and I was like, no Tibet, no Tibet. They were mostly all Indian or Nepali men. And I was like, this is food. This is food native. It's like the unofficial, national food of Tibet, and not a single Tibetan owner. We've had so many mom and pop Tibetan momo shops in India, in Nepal, that were there decades before it became a mainstream street food in our host countries of India and Nepal. So I was like, how come none of them are owned by Japan? So that day, I got so much courage. Of course, I'm still very risk averse and still so scared.
And still very courageous, though, I think.
But that fire in me was stronger than the fear that I had, so it didn't hold me back. And I decided that day that I am going to build the first woman-owned Tibetan food brand, a momo brand, a dumpling brand in the US, And I know it's going to be a very long journey because how capital intensive it is, the resources, the barriers, financial barriers, extremely high, which is why you don't see any small scale mom and pop shop brands in the freezer aisle of grocery stores, because of the logistics and whatnot, the costs are extremely high. But I decided that day that, like everything in my life that I had done up until that point, I'm going to do the best I can with what I have, and I'm going to chip away, bite size approach, and get there. And so that's kind of been my my journey and my driving force. Before that, I had explored and reached out to some community business organizations that I designed to guide entrepreneurs or prospective entrepreneurs and things like that. And I remember being told by a couple of them, and I think they meant it with the best of intentions, very gently saying, you have a very well-paying job, you have two little ones, this is a very niche product you're trying to sell, Americans are unfamiliar with it, plus on top of that, it's frozen you want to sell, the barriers to entry are even higher for that, Yeah, so all of that stuck with me and to a degree paralyzed me in fear. But that day when I came across this article, it just gave me so much courage.
Well, you have that very strong why, which you mentioned. I think that gets you through these, because that must have been daunting. I know when you started researching frozen foods, there was an incredible ramp up time and also a lot of regulations. As
Absolutely.
Obstacles to getting these well packaged and sold.
Absolutely. From two angles. One is the regulations. FDA, USDA regulations are extremely stringent and also becomes very costly, especially for small scale startups like me. Also, the logistics, from the operation side, the logistics, just the nature of frozen food alone, of maintaining the freezing temperatures and things like that, makes it also a very costly endeavor, which is why I currently, at this stage, I haven't started shipping nationally, because I've approached cold shipping companies, but it becomes a chicken or egg kind of thing, where they'll say, we need a minimum order of this per month. And I'm like, well, I haven't been given an opportunity to build that up. So how can I produce that immediately? It'll be a ramp up time to do that, which is why I haven't done it. And I'm focused on expanding my representation, a footprint in a local farmers market, which I'm so grateful for farmers market platforms, because truly it's what's enabled me and empowered me, the sales from it, to kind of start inching closer to that dream of going nationwide one day.
I know when we buy your momos and hand pies, we order a lot of times online, and then we could pick it up, say, the next day on a Saturday at the market, or if you're at a Sunday market or a night market, and now people can do the same with the cafe,
exactly.
Which has limited hours. I think Friday dinner and lunches from Thursday to Saturday.
Saturday, exactly. This week, I just expanded to add lunch hours. So we're open from Thursdays through Saturdays, 11 to 2. And then for dinner service, just Friday evenings for now.
And people can either eat there or pick up the frozen momos
exactly.
and hand pies. Now, Kiki, when you started Himalayan Dumplings, it was, we've talked about not only to represent your culture through food, but to pass on some of your Tibetan heritage to your customers and to your daughters, who are fourth generation Tibetans in exile, if we can call them that. When people drop by to pick up their order, many of them learning about Tibetan food for the first time, how do you talk to them about the story of Tibet and its culture beyond the food?
Yeah. It depends on how busy it is.
For oh, yes, if there's a big line.
Yeah. Our pop-up events always has extremely long lines, so it's quite impossible to talk. But I created business cards recently, so I started handing them out with the hope that they will start following me on social media, where I do most of the storytelling. Also, when I opened up my cafe, my little Himalayan dumpling shop, I was very intentional with the decor in it. I don't know if you can see, but I have three printout posters on my wall. One that speaks about the background, gives a little bit of cultural and historical context on what is a momo, because it's a very misunderstood momo, where a lot of people think these are dumplings from Nepal because of the huge presence and influence of Tibetan culture there. And now in recent years, people are starting to say dumplings from India, which is also inaccurate. So I wanted to clarify that. But also I have a poster about what is Tibet and where is Tibet, and an explanation of that. And then a poster about a story and why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Oh, and it looks like prayer flags on that one.
Yeah. So these have actually been really good conversation starters. I don't necessarily initiate, because I know different people have different interest or comfort level in learning about something beyond just a plate of food that they came for. So the posters have been really good conversation starters and people asking me more follow-up questions from there. But largely, I rely on social media to do the storytelling because I find that when people visit a cafe or at a pop-up farmers market, a good percentage of those customers start following my journey on social media.
Now, Kiki, you're part of a generation of Tibetans that's been scattered across the world. I think you've called it the Tibetan diaspora. And these Tibetans have never set foot in Tibet. It's probably too dangerous for them, given the repression there, the crackdown on Tibetan culture by the Chinese government. I know when I was there, even pictures of the Dalai Lama are forbidden. Do you feel a responsibility, kind of as a Tibetan refugee, to preserve and promote the culture, not only locally to the Tibetan community, but worldwide?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I often share on my social media, my mission is to share a Tibetan story far and wide, nationwide, and maybe across outside of the US, how I know best, and that is through the lens of food. And so even on my bags, for example, the retail frozen ready to cook Himalayan dumpling bags at the back, I was very intentional with how I use that space. And I have a little blurb about my story, which is interconnected to the Tibetan story. Because, like I said, it is more than just food for me. Food will be the initial gateway of introduction, but my hope is that it will generate enough curiosity to learn a little bit more about where that food came from and why I'm doing this.
How has it been for your daughters? Have they learned more about Tibetan culture? I think probably helping you prepare some of the food and sell it at the markets.
Yeah, so they have definitely been helping me at the cafe. They are my emergency staff. I have such a lean operations out of necessity, because the profit margins are so slim in the food industry. So if someone calls in sick and I'm short-staffed, my daughters, who are now 13 and 12, they help me. At the back in the kitchen or front of the house. So they help me. In terms of their engagement, it varies. They are, again, half Tibetan, half Cambodian, also born in the US. One of the things that I try to do is, as a parent, is not project or not, how do you say? My lived experience, I have to remind myself, is quite different than the lived experiences of my daughters. And I
To
try to
kind
be,
of force it on them or
yeah, and I try to be respectful of that and give them the space to learn as they're comfortable or as they're interested. But it's always there in the background. That I make sure that it's always there in the background that they don't forget. But in terms of how they want to actively engage on it, I give them a little bit of autonomy as a parent. I think it's important. So I don't push it on them because, like I said, as much as I want to, my lived experience as a Tibetan who grew up in a densely Tibetan refugee community in India and Nepal is very different than my daughters who are half Tibetan, half Cambodian, who were born in the US.
Now, I know you have a big dream, and we've talked a little bit about it, a longer-term goal for Himalayan dumplings, and that's to get on grocery store shelves and become this nationwide brand. But also, do you have a dream of one day returning to Tibet to visit and maybe bring your daughters with you? I know it might be difficult because, given the situation now, it doesn't seem like things are getting any better or easier there.
I don't think that will be possible, at least not in the near future.
It seems like something you wish you could do, though. I'm sorry. It's
That's
emotional
okay.
for you, and I could understand
Yeah,
that.
absolutely. It is my dream, as it is the dream of probably majority of the Tibetans. You can see on social media comments if there is any current day video of Tibet posted by tourists and things like that, you'll see many Tibetans commenting, "Thank you for sharing that, so we can see what it's like," even if it's on a superficial level and it doesn't really cover or show what really goes beyond that face value. So yeah, I would love to be able to, in this life, be able to return to a free Tibet, but I don't think I would want to visit if it's still occupied. I just don't know if I would have the strength to I don't know, experience it that way. But I don't know, who knows, time will tell. But the reality I do want to point out that is not very well known is that majority of Tibetans, even those living in sovereign nations, have hold, for example, US citizenship as I do. Majority of us will never get granted a tourist visa to visit Tibet. Only a very few people will get after very rigorous background screening to ensure that there will be no, how do you say, it'll be a very compliant visit.
Yes, I told you. My wife and I were there in 2018, and we were very closely watched. We were in a small tour group, which was the only way to get it in and about the country. And I hope also you fulfill that dream and all the other Tibetan refugees in this lifetime. Kiki, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today about Himalayan dumplings, your experience as both a Tibetan refugee, as part of the Tibetan diaspora and a successful businesswoman, amazingly so. I'd like to leave with a few of your words for our listeners that I read in a previous interview you gave. If you have a dream, go ahead and give it a try. Thaksheshe.
Thank you so much, Ken. I really appreciate the time and space. Thank you.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it, if we had a director, you can listen anytime, on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Kiki, owner of Himalayan Dumplings, the first woman-owned Tibetan food brand in the U.S., which makes and sells Tibetan dumplings or momos and hand pies. And now Kiki has her own cafe located at 16755 Southwest Baseline Road in Beaverton. You can find out more about Himalayan dumplings and order some of those amazing momos and hand pies for yourself online at HimalayanDumplings.com. Just a note that KABU is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. It's holiday season, and our KABU end-of-year campaign is in full swing. So there's no better time to show your support for the station and programming like this by becoming a member yourself or renewing your membership. Just go online to kabu.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, December 28th at 11 a.m. We'll have a special Christmas present for you. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying hope to see you all again then.